to me as if the boys are inexperienced. Nodding in agreement, McConnell muttered that this was so. The chiefs allowed the president to blame the mission's failure on the boys who executed it, rather than emphasize how both the restrictions on the amount of force and the rules of engagement compromised the Rolling Thunder attacks. They therefore put themselves on the defensive, rather than force the president to face the consequences of his policies. LBJ told the JCS, "Now, I'm like a coach I used to know, and you're my team. You're all Johnson men." Referring to the situation in Vietnam, the president continued with his metaphor. "We played the first half of the game, and the score is now 21-0 against us. Now I want you to tell me how to win." LBJ's eyes turned to Wheeler. "You're graduates of the military academy, and you should be able to give me an answer. I want you to come back here next Tuesday and tell me how we are going to kill more Viet Cong." The president appeared committed to invest whatever level of force the JCS determined was necessary to win the war in the South. He observed that, "At present, we are limited as to what we can do in North Vietnam, but we have almost free rein in South Vietnam, and I want to kill more Viet Cong." Although he had essentially placed any discussion of intensifying the air campaign against North Vietnam off limits, Johnson pledged a willingness to spend the money and, if necessary, to move the Joint Chiefs of Staff right out to Saigon to improve the situation. He asked them to tell him what we can do to win. Despite his professed desire to win, the president attempted to exact from the chiefs a recommendation consistent with his desire to maintain domestic political consensus. He hoped to generate among them an understanding of his need to limit military action against the North. He told them that he was having trouble with Congress and the public. He leaned backward in his chair, pointing out a pile of telegrams on the desk behind him. He told the JCS that the telegrams were all criticisms of the speech I made last night at Johns Hopkins. "I thought I was doing pretty well. I got 14 applauses in 40 minutes, but those letters don't look that way." After making clear his insecurity and need for support, Coach Johnson told his team what he expected. First, the president wanted the JCS to prevent criticisms from the field from reaching the media and the American public. He referred to recent press reports that the war had been controlled too tightly from Washington and told the JCS that, "As long as I'm commander-in-chief, I'm going to control from Washington." He ordered Wheeler to identify and punish those who had complained to reporters. Wheeler promised that he would. Johnson then told the JCS to shift their strategic focus away from the controversial bombing of North Vietnam and toward additional action in South Vietnam. He asked Wheeler, "How many Viet Cong have we killed since you were here last time?" Wheeler had no figures, so Deputy Secretary of Defense Vance helped the chairman make an estimate. The president appeared disappointed. He wanted to know how many Viet Cong have been killed since the 1st of January and how many Vietnamese have been killed by the Viet Cong and how many Americans. It appeared that the president, having discussed the war in terms of a football game, was intent on keeping score by tracking the numbers of dead on both sides. Green, who had grown frustrated with the disparity between the president's tough talk and limitations on the use of force, leaned forward and told Johnson, "Mr. President, the last time I came over here was last month on the 15th of March. When I left the meeting that day, I had the clear idea you wanted more VC killed. I thought that you really meant that. But here it is, almost a month later, the 8th of April, and we are just getting permission to modify our security mission to permit us to go out and kill Viet Cong. Furthermore, were just getting approval from the Vietnamese government for the introduction of more Marines into the Da Nang area, and I also assume approval of a combat killing mission for the Da Nang Marine Forces. Green told the president that the Marine Force currently in the South, two reinforced battalions of about 1,600 men each, was inadequate. Green used the president's demand to kill more Viet Cong to argue for a much larger U.S. Marine effort in South Vietnam. He observed that offensive operations against the enemy would require additional troops and suggested that the Marine commander on the ground be given the authority to bring in as many Marines from the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force based in Okinawa as he deemed necessary to expand his operations. Green suggested that South Vietnamese Marine units supplement U.S. Marine forces to conduct combined Viet Cong killing operations, noting that the Marines were trained to operate together as an air-ground team. He observed that a Marine air squadron was not yet positioned in Da Nang. Once the first squadron arrived, he would need a second to operate in close teamwork with our ground Marines. LBJ was not yet prepared to consider specific proposals. Having told the JCS why further action against the North was out of the question, and having communicated his need for support, he deferred any consideration of Green's recommendation until their next meeting. He told the JCS that Green's proposal was the kind of information I want you all to give me next Tuesday when you come back to talk again. As the chiefs rose to leave, the photographer continued to move about the room to record the president's consultation with his military advisors. LBJ motioned for the chiefs to gather around his desk. Picking up a handful of the telegrams he had referred to earlier, the president told them, "This is the sort of thing I am up against. This is the sort of stuff I am getting from the public." Johnson then asked the officers to step outside into the garden for some additional photographs. During the second photo, Green switched positions with McDonald and stood next to the president. Having read the Johns Hopkins speech in the morning paper, the Marine Corps commandant sought to reassure the president, telling him that the speech was the best one given during the past administrations, and that he was sure that there were a lot of people in the country who felt just as I did. LBJ had performed well. Green was impressed by the clear worry that dominated the president's demeanor. To prevent the chiefs from questioning limitations on the use of force against the North, the president played for their sympathy, asking that they be team players. Lest the chiefs underestimate the seriousness with which he regarded their support, LBJ made veiled threats to relieve his military advisors or supplant their role. He said that he had considered sending General Shoup, the retired Marine Corps commandant, to take charge of the whole military situation in South Vietnam, but had decided against it because there were already too many generals out there. Unwilling to intensify the air campaign or deploy large numbers of U.S. troops to the south, he pressured the chiefs to kill more Viet Cong with troops and materiel currently available to them. Although he registered no objections during the meeting, Green recorded that the president does not seem to grasp the details of what can and cannot be done in Vietnam. Recognizing the temporizing measures would not produce tangible results, Green believed that the United States faced the difficult decision of either withdrawing from Vietnam or staying to fight a major campaign. In a memo that he passed out to his colleagues just prior to the meeting with the president, Green had recommended the immediate deployment of one Marine Expeditionary Force, one Army Division, and one South Korean Division to South Vietnam. After a 10-day grace period following the Johns Hopkins speech, the United States would commence a rapid, significant, sustained increase in pressures against North Vietnam, including unrestricted airstrikes on enemy military and industrial targets. the mining of Haiphong Harbor, shore bombardment of coastal and island targets, and seizure of the latter with South Vietnamese troops. Simultaneously, the United States would prepare for a total blockade of North Vietnamese ports and put the American economy on a wartime footing. The president, however, did not wish to make such a firm commitment to war, lest he alienate any of his constituencies. Secretary of Defense McNamara remained Johnson's principal assistant in pursuing a middle ground in Vietnam and in concealing from Congress and the public the fact that an expanded U.S. effort on the ground in South Vietnam was underway. The defense secretary told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that it will be the president's desire and purpose to consult with the Congress, the leadership of the Congress, members of this committee, before undertaking any combat moves of personnel that would potentially enlarge the war. Taylor assisted McNamara in this deception. Before he returned to Saigon, the ambassador had assured the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that no one is approaching a decision of this magnitude at this moment. He promised the senators that if a large-scale deployment was needed, you are going to be consulted, I am perfectly sure. Separately, Dean Rusk had assured Senator Church and his colleagues that large-scale troop deployments were not at all in contemplation, and that we would naturally consult with appropriate Senate leaders before we seriously considered such a step. Based on consultation with Taylor, Westmoreland sensed that the deployment of division-sized forces is not in the immediate offing. Accordingly, he suggested that he and the JCS work with the president's approach to gain approval for sending to Vietnam the largest number of troops possible without attracting intense congressional scrutiny. On April 11th, he suggested that the JCS recommend redeployment of the 173rd Airborne Brigade from Okinawa to the central highlands of South Vietnam. He reasoned, as he had earlier, that the deployment of brigade-sized forces from Okinawa would attract less public and congressional attention than that of division-sized forces from the United States. Westmoreland suggested that the JCS work within the constraints of the president's domestic agenda by gradually, rather than suddenly, expanding the U.S. commitment in Vietnam. On April 13th, the JCS and McNamara returned to the White House for lunch with the president. Johnson continued to play for sympathy from the chiefs while criticizing their performance. He thought it unfair that he had borne the blame for some 18 months by himself. If the situation in Vietnam continued to deteriorate, he threatened, he would share the blame with those who had been giving him advice. Johnson also remained determined to preempt discussion of an intensification of military actions against the North. He again made clear his intention to retain tight control over military operations. He promised more determined action in the future, however, and vowed to increase the tempo of bombing targets below the 20th parallel. Because the president limited the discussion to actions within South Vietnam and wished to maintain tight control over the air campaign against the North, Air Force Chief of Staff General McConnell restricted his recommendations to minor changes that he would carry out in-house without presidential approval. Similarly, Admiral McDonald indicated that the Navy was taking measures to improve sea surveillance of the North Vietnamese coast. Although he forestalled discussion of the air campaign against North Vietnam, Johnson professed enthusiasm for any JCS proposal to intensify the war in the South. He again emphasized that he would even move the JCS to Saigon to handle the situation themselves. LBJ assured the chiefs that he would invest whatever amount of money, materiel, or effort necessary to win the game in South Vietnam and start killing more Viet Cong. The president asked for Wheeler's recommendations. the chairman restated the JCS recommendation of March 20th that three divisions deploy to South Vietnam. As Wheeler spoke, the president began to calculate the total number of troops that would then be deployed in South Vietnam, arriving at a total of 180,000. Despite his pledge to commit to South Vietnam the forces the JCS deemed necessary, the president said that he could never get Congress to go along with that large a number of troops. Besides, the president noted, a large troop deployment might incite a reaction from North Vietnam and China. Unhappy with Wheeler's advice, the president indicated that he would be willing to approve the deployment of 5,000 troops instead of the 90,000 that would attend the deployment of three divisions. He made the point with an analogy. It is just as if you went to a bank owned by Mr. McNamara and asked him for a loan of $90,000, and he told you no, he couldn't let you have that amount, but he would loan you $5,000. What would you do? Let your business go into bankruptcy? Or would you take the $5,000 and try to do something with it? Johnson wanted the JCS to tell him how to reverse the deteriorating situation in South Vietnam cheaply and quickly. He told his senior military officers that he was willing to send a reasonable number of troops to South Vietnam, but was never going to agree at this time to three divisions. Something else on a smaller scale would have to be tried. After making his point, the president turned to Harold Johnson and asked for his assessment. When the Army Chief of Staff reiterated the JCS estimate that three divisions were the minimum force necessary, LBJ turned quickly to General Greene. The president was counting on the Commandant of the Marine Corps, whom McNamara had earlier described to him as immature, to break with his colleagues and make a recommendation that would not precipitate a congressional debate. When the chiefs first arrived at the White House, LBJ had shaken the general's hand warmly and said in a low voice, "I want some good recommendations from you today." After General Johnson reinforced Wheeler's three-division proposal, the president addressed the group. "The last time you were over here, Wally Greene had a proposal to make, which we partially heard, that had to do with combined operations with the South Vietnamese. Now let's hear what he has to say." The president's pandering had the desired effect. Greene gave Johnson the advice he wanted. The commandant described a proposal for combined operations as a program that could be bought cheaply and might be successful. Johnson responded that he was willing to throw another chip on the table, amounting to 5,000 more U.S. Marines if necessary, in order to carry this plan out. Although McNamara interjected that Greene's proposal would require some study, the president remained enthusiastic. LBJ thought that this recommendation should be tried out, and if it failed, we wouldn't have lost and could go on and try something else. After his meeting with the chiefs, Johnson approved Westmoreland's request for the 173rd Airborne Brigade. The two April meetings between the president and the JCS added greater confusion to an already muddled strategic picture of what the U.S. military was to accomplish in Vietnam. The president's curtailment of their discussion to only those initiatives that would kill more Viet Cong prevented the development of a comprehensive plan for the war. Instead of defining policy goals precisely and then determining how military force might contribute to those goals, the president's discussion with the chiefs began with how much force he was willing to invest in the near term and assumed, with no thought for the nature of the war, that any action would constitute progress in the war effort. The chiefs were to make their recommendations not according to agreed-on objectives, but according to the means the president made available, based on domestic political priorities. In the absence of clearly defined strategic objectives, killing more Viet Cong, a tactical mission, became the basis for JCS plans and recommendations. After their meetings with the president, the JCS set the joint and service staffs to work to determine how we can increase the Viet Cong kill rate within the framework of our present posture in Southeast Asia. The JCS concluded that with the current force levels, they might kill more Viet Cong through the massive application of air power in the south. It remained unclear, however, how the tactic of using massive airstrikes against an enemy who was intertwined with the non-combatant population would help to establish strategic conditions conducive to ending the war. Because the bombing of North Vietnam had incited opposition, the piecemeal introduction of small numbers of ground troops seemed to the president the path of least resistance. Through this course of action, Johnson might assuage the chief's desire for additional action while continuing to obscure the nature of America's growing military commitment from those who were opposed to military intervention in Vietnam. Public, congressional, and international opposition to bombing North Vietnam had dimmed the luster of what had been the politically cheap course of action. Although intensified action against the North might inflame emerging critics of the Vietnam policy, such as Senators Morse, Fulbright, and Church, a few more Marines or an Army brigade stationed in the Philippines might slip into South Vietnam without inciting a politically damaging debate. The president had used differences among the chiefs to his advantage before, and service parochialism continued to be a debilitating influence on the JCS. Green's desire to increase the Marine Corps role in Vietnam led him to spare the president the hard, cold facts that he and the Marine Corps staff had recorded in an estimate of the situation. Instead, he urged a cheap deployment of 5,000 more Marines, 100-fold fewer than he thought would ultimately be required to fight a major campaign. LBJ had impressed Green with his very forceful and impressive manner and had left the general with no doubt in my mind that he meant business and that he expected the Joint Chiefs to produce and that he wanted more Viet Cong killed. Wheeler recognized how Lyndon Johnson had manipulated the JCS, but he remained unwilling to confront his commander-in-chief. When he returned to the Pentagon, he summoned his colleagues to his office. Greatly distressed, he told the chiefs that they had been led into a trap. When Green asked Wheeler what he meant, the chairman responded heatedly that they had not stuck by their original agreement to hold fast on the chief's previous recommendation to introduce three divisions into South Vietnam. Green protested. Although he affirmed his support for the introduction of three divisions, he argued that he wasn't going to sit at the table and tell Mr. Johnson that I didn't have anything to say or refer him to the chairman, indicating that the chairman would speak for me. Green contended, furthermore, that his recommendations were perfectly sound, that everyone present had the opportunity to examine them and discuss them if they didn't like them, and that no one had done this. Wheeler, who had already reconciled himself to working for a gradual intensification of the war, suppressed his anger and got on with the business of deploying more troops to South Vietnam. On April 14th, he sent a message to Sinh Pak, MACV, and the Saigon Embassy, detailing the decisions that the president had made in his April 13th meeting with the JCS. He instructed the military commanders to accomplish the following actions as soon as Ambassador Taylor obtained approval from the South Vietnamese government. Deploy 173rd Airborne Brigade and necessary support elements to Ben Hoa, Vung Tau area, with the initial mission of security of U.S. installations and facilities. Expand initial mission to include engagement in counterinsurgency combat operations. The final paragraph of the JCS cable instructed addressees to make no public statements and ordered that the deployment be treated as low-key. In a separate cable, Wheeler informed Westmoreland that he would personally control and carefully monitor the initial Marine Corps offensive operations and directed that those operations begin with small patrols. Wheeler concluded that barring an emergency, he did not visualize battalion-size operations occurring for several weeks. Thus, despite his feeling that Johnson had trapped the JCS, Wheeler supported the president's deception of Congress and the American public about the changed nature of the American involvement in the war. Westmoreland, in response to Wheeler's instruction to keep the president's decisions low-key, suggested that the administration take the public stance that U.S. ground forces were merely providing support for South Vietnamese units rather than conducting independent offensive operations. Chapter 14, War Without Direction, April to June, 1965. LBJ played a role between the Doves and the Hawks, and he did it in much the same way he used to conduct his majority leadership. He did it on the notion that here was some middle ground, always, on which the majority of the votes could be secured. That was true in the Senate, where you have to find that consensus in order to enact legislation. But I think the role of the president is different from that of a senator, and that this was a matter of policy that could not be cut down the middle. And his constant attempt to do it led him always to temper the military on the one hand, and yet to generally move in the direction of larger warfare, reluctantly reaching out left and right in the hope that maybe something would give, some kind of peace would become possible. But nevertheless, moving with the mainstream and, on that, trying to base a consensus. Senator Frank Church, 1969. The United States was at war, but LBJ's preoccupation with pursuing a middle course in Vietnam prevented a clear articulation of the objective of military force. American soldiers, airmen, and Marines went to war in Vietnam without strategy or direction. Because he continued to deceive the Congress and the public, the president could ill afford dissension within his own administration that might reveal his actual policy decisions. Having secured his political flanks against opposition from the JCS, the president now faced a potential threat from his ambassador in Saigon. The decision to deploy the 173rd Airborne Brigade came as a complete surprise to Taylor. He responded to the news by arguing that the presence of American ground combat units was not only unnecessary, but counterproductive. He observed that the principal rationale for the introduction of more troops could be adduced to justify almost unlimited additional deployments. He restated his earlier arguments against deploying American ground combat units, including his judgment that their presence would sap the Government of Vietnam initiative and turn a defense of the Government of Vietnam homeland into what appears a foreign war. Although Taylor approved of logistical preparations for future contingencies, he recommended that American units remain outside of South Vietnam just as long as possible and until their need is incontrovertible. He described the deployment of the 173rd Airborne and more Marine units as wasteful. McGeorge Bundy reported to the president that Taylor had discovered the planned deployment of the 173rd Brigade due to a premature JCS message and had already come in questioning it. Bundy suggested that based on Taylor's assessment, it is not clear that we now need all these additional forces. He indicated to the president that he was not sure that you yourself currently wish to make a firm decision to put another 10,000 to 15,000 combat troops in Vietnam today. Bundy's resistance to the deployment stemmed primarily, however, from his desire to protect the president from a public or congressional flap that would attend any inkling of dissent from Taylor. Bundy recommended, in light of Taylor's opposition to the deployment of the 173rd Airborne, that the president delay direct orders of this sort to Taylor, because they would be very explosive right now. Taylor's opposition, Bundy explained, was based partially on the feeling that he had not been consulted. Bundy reassured the president that we can turn him around if we give him a little time to come on board. To soften the tone of instructions to Taylor, Bundy described the troop deployments and other measures as experimental steps that the highest authority thought were needed to add something new in the South to achieve victory. Those experiments included Green's proposal for the American and South Vietnamese combined operations, the introduction of the 173rd Airborne to the Central Highlands region, both to act as a security force for our installations and also to participate in counterinsurgency combat operations, and the deployment of multi-battalion forces into two or three additional locations along the coast to experiment further with U.S. forces in a counterinsurgency role. Despite Bundy's efforts to mislead Taylor, the ambassador was incredulous. Taylor sensed that U.S. policy had devolved into a collection of disparate initiatives lacking any unifying strategic concept or clear objective. Accordingly, he expressed confusion over the rapidly changing picture of Washington desires and intentions with regard to the introduction of combat forces. He stated that he needed a clarification of our purposes and objectives in a new policy of participation in ground combat. Taylor was greatly troubled by Washington's proclivity to equate any new program or initiative with an improvement in the situation in Vietnam. He expressed frustration over trying to get a weak South Vietnamese government to implement a 21-point military program, a 16-point propaganda program, and a 12-point CIA program, as well as organize and gain approval for the introduction of U.S. ground combat forces. It seemed to the ambassador that Washington was trying to win the war on a point score, and he protested that he was getting helped to death. When Taylor's response arrived, the president was at his ranch, relishing the progress that his domestic legislative program was making through Congress, but he remained concerned about international and domestic opposition to his Vietnam policy. Although the Johns Hopkins speech had been a success, it had done nothing to appease those who were urging the president to stop the bombing of North Vietnam. McGeorge Bundy, therefore, had suggested that the president make a strong peace-loving statement designed to diffuse emotion behind planned anti-bombing demonstrations in Washington and at the gates of LBJ's ranch. Addressing reporters from the front porch on April 17th, the president stressed the familiar themes of restraint and determination that remained the rhetorical foundation for maintaining consensus behind his Vietnam policy. He told reporters that he regretted that the necessities of war have compelled us to bomb North Vietnam, and emphasized that his administration had carefully limited those raids and directed them toward concrete and steel and not human life. To pacify those who might oppose his policy on the grounds that he was irresolute, Johnson publicly committed himself to win the war in Vietnam, although he understood and shared the feelings of those who regret that we must undertake air attacks. He pledged that until the freedom and independence of South Vietnam were guaranteed, there is no human power capable of forcing us from Vietnam. He promised that the United States would remain in South Vietnam as long as is necessary, with the might that is required, whatever the risk and whatever the cost. To placate those who opposed American military action against North Vietnam, the president at once reverted to the language of peace, with a restatement of his desire to help the poor and weak nations in Southeast Asia through economic development and technological progress on the American model. Although he made no mention of the change of mission for U.S. troops or the impending deployment of additional units, he told reporters that, "Yesterday, only yesterday, I sent a team of rural electrification experts to Saigon to help extend the healing miracles of electricity to the Vietnamese countryside." Taylor, meanwhile, warned that the arrival of the 173rd Brigade would signal a new policy and that any initiative that resembled military occupation would receive wide publicity. As Taylor pressured the president to halt the increase in U.S. forces, the JCS urged McNamara to dismiss Taylor's objections. The chief's plans called for troops actively to seek out and engage the enemy in close combat and highlighted the need for more troops to secure U.S. bases. They used the circular argument that logistics bases established to prepare for the possibility of larger troop deployments required more combat troops to secure them. The chiefs implied that Taylor was dragging his feet in gaining South Vietnamese approval for additional troops and suggested that the president determine whether the ambassador was obstructing military deployments already approved by highest U.S. authority. Rather than assess the validity of Taylor's reservations about the consequences of introducing progressively larger numbers of troops, the JCS remained fixated on gaining approval for additional deployments. The president, unwilling to risk open dissent with either Taylor or the JCS, depended on McNamara to effect a compromise between them. Johnson suspended the deployment of the 173rd Airborne Brigade while McNamara met with Taylor, McNaughton, Westmoreland, Wheeler, Sharp, and William Bundy in Honolulu. McNamara would have to persuade Taylor to accept the deployment of additional troops while parrying calls from the military for an intensification of the air campaign against North Vietnam. McNamara did not disappoint the president. On his way back from Hawaii, he summarized the agreement arranged between civilian and military officials. He told the president that it would take about 1 or 2 years for U.S. ground troops to demonstrate VC failure in the South. He reported that the conferees had agreed that the troops that he and the others were currently recommending might not be enough, and that it would be unwise to attempt to fix any time limit to the war. The strategic objective had shifted from coercing Hanoi with limited airstrikes and other pressures to frustrating communist designs for domination of the South by denying them victory. McCone recorded that McNamara returned from Honolulu, arguing to change the purpose of the bombing attacks on North Vietnam to one of continual harassment, while U.S. and South Vietnamese ground forces in the South convinced North Vietnam that the Viet Cong effort was hopeless. McNamara had gained Taylor's support for increasing U.S. forces in Vietnam to 82,000, which would be followed by a possible deployment of 41,000 more U.S. troops. The outcome of the Honolulu Conference was a sort of compromise that might result from a congressional committee meeting. McNamara had been the president's committee chairman, charged with persuading others to support the president's approach to Vietnam. He allied himself with Taylor to oppose Wheeler's and Westmoreland's request for 3 divisions, and then persuaded Taylor to support an increase in U.S. strength in Vietnam by promising that future troop deployments would be subject to strict scrutiny. For Westmoreland and Wheeler, McNamara suggested possible later deployments, not recommended now, including over 56,000 more troops from the Army's Air Mobile Division, a Corps headquarters, and the remainder of the Marine Expeditionary Force. Westmoreland recalled that although the consensus position of the Honolulu Conference did not contain a force to retake the critical Central Highlands, he took solace in the larger forces included as possible later deployments. The JCS did not receive permission to deploy three divisions, but troop strength in Vietnam more than doubled from 33,000 to 82,000. If disagreements persisted, McNamara suppressed them. The report to the president, Sharp observed years later, reflected McNamara's own views, not necessarily a consensus. Wheeler and Sharp had recommended intensifying the air campaign, but McNamara reported to LBJ that, with respect to strikes against the North, they all agree that the present tempo is about right. Sharp later described McNamara's memo as a distortion. George Ball recognized that the president was failing to consider the likely consequences of his decisions to increase gradually the number of U.S. troops in Vietnam. He recalled years afterward that before McNamara returned from Honolulu, he warned the president not to take such a hazardous leap into space without further exploring the possibilities of a settlement. Ball echoed Humphrey's warning that the situation in Vietnam was more ambiguous and hence more dubious than in the Korean War. The American public, Ball argued, would not tolerate U.S. casualties if the war continued without a resolution in sight. Ball stopped short, however, of objecting forcefully to the direction of U.S. policy. He described his resistance to the growing ground troop commitment as a deliberate stalling tactic. Like the JCS, Ball was unwilling to press the president to choose between large-scale intervention and withdrawal. As the president's advisors would not confront directly the confusion and contradictions apparent in LBJ's middle course, the United States continued to deepen its involvement in the war without a clear objective or strategy for the employment of American military force. According to Admiral Sharp, at the outset of the Honolulu meeting, it was clear that McNamara had decided to downgrade the air war against North Vietnam and to emphasize the air and ground war in South Vietnam. McNamara recalled in his memoir that his and the chief's focus on day-to-day events had prevented them from developing a military strategy and a long-term plan for the force structure to carry it out. More precisely, McNamara's effort to satisfy the president's desire for consensus obscured the long-term implications of the administration's decisions. Having secured a consensus in Honolulu behind the shift in objectives, the president sought to widen that consensus to include all of his Washington advisors. On April 21st, he met with McNamara, Rusk, Ball, McGeorge Bundy, Director of Central Intelligence McCone, and Vice Admiral William Rayburn, who would replace McCone in 2 days. The president, who had squelched JCS recommendations for the expansion of Rolling Thunder, feigned confusion. He asked McNamara why the Honolulu group had not recommended more resolute military action against North Vietnam. "Are we pulling away from our theory that bombing will turn them off?" McNamara, the father of graduated pressure, responded, "That wasn't our theory. We wanted to lift morale. We wanted to push them toward negotiations. We've done that." McCone sounded the lone objection. As he had done before, he urged the president to consider possible enemy reactions to the introduction of U.S. ground forces. McCone again predicted that the North Vietnamese would respond in kind to the U.S. effort in South Vietnam, so that troop deployments would produce no definite result. Wheeler and Ball, both of whom questioned the wisdom of the president's chosen course, nevertheless supported Johnson's decisions. Ball resolved to impede greater military involvement, whereas Wheeler sought to accelerate it. The next day, as U.S. Marines saw their first combat in South Vietnam, the president approved the Honolulu recommendations. Although Johnson's advisors had recommended that he include Congress in his decision, there was no consultation. No memorandum promulgated the decision, and there was no public announcement. In his instructions to Ambassador Taylor, the president directed that it was not our intention to announce the whole program now, but rather to announce individual deployments at appropriate times. Meanwhile, the communist buildup that McCone predicted was well underway. Encouraged by popular unrest in the South, the persistent instability in the Saigon government, and the growing anti-war sentiment in the United States, Hanoi's leaders sensed an opportunity to gain decisive victory. As American ground combat units arrived in the South, the chief of the North Vietnamese Politburo, Lê Duan, advocated a combined Viet Cong, North Vietnamese army offensive aimed at achieving victory before the United States could intervene in force. By mid-April, it was clear to U.S. intelligence officials that Hanoi was dispatching not just individual soldiers, but trained and ready North Vietnamese army units to South Vietnam. The offensive was set to begin in May with the onset of the monsoon season. As Vietnamese communist forces prepared for the summer offensive, a crisis in the Caribbean temporarily diverted U.S. attention from Southeast Asia. Beginning on April 24th, supporters of the former civilian president of the Dominican Republic, Juan Bosch, tried to overthrow the military junta that had forced Bosch from office. On April 28th, President Johnson ordered U.S. Marines into the capital, Santo Domingo, for the protection of U.S. citizens. Whatever the initial justification, the operation grew rapidly in scale, involving more than 20,000 troops in order to prevent a communist takeover that would result in another Cuba in the Caribbean. Although he was aware that the intervention would expose him to charges of gunboat diplomacy, Johnson thought that the public and congressional criticism would be nothing compared to what I'd be called if the Dominican Republic went down the drain. Faced with growing congressional criticism and the prospect of Vietnam protests and debates, the president sought to defuse opposition, William Bundy recalling that the Dominican intervention and its rationale came under heavy fire in the very quarters, both at home and abroad, that were already skeptical or hostile to the Vietnam actions, wrote later that the president responded to the congressional pressure by what can only be described as a gimmick. The Dominican crisis gave the president an opportunity to overcome opposition to his Vietnam policy. On May 4th, Johnson sent to Congress a request for $700 million to support additional efforts both in Vietnam and the Dominican Republic. The president told Congress, "This is not a routine appropriation. For each member of Congress who supports this request is also voting to persist in our effort to halt communist aggression in South Vietnam. Each is saying that the Congress and the president stand united before the world in joint determination that the independence of South Vietnam shall be preserved and communist attack will not succeed." Reminding the legislators that more than 400 Americans have given their lives in Vietnam, the president made it clear that a vote against the bill was a vote against those brave men who are risking their lives for freedom in Vietnam. William Bundy recalled that the president's tactic was to make the appropriation of a relatively small sum, not in fact related to any specific program or its costs, into a small-scale, new Tonkin Gulf resolution. And all this in a week when the American people were confronting the idea of a second Cuba, of a communist threat at their doorstep. Like the Tonkin Gulf resolution, the president's bill passed overwhelmingly. 408-7 in the House and 88-3 in the Senate. As Rhode Island's Claiborne Pell, a Democrat, observed, voting against the appropriation would have been like voting against motherhood. The president had presented the legislators with a fait accompli. After U.S. ground troops arrived in Vietnam, the president could equate a vote against his policy with the abandonment of American soldiers and Marines at the front. Representative Dante Fassel, a Democrat from Florida, recalled that the patriotic impulse to support the troops had become the linchpin for greater involvement in Vietnam. Despite the president's coup over the legislators, domestic and international pressures to stop the bombing of North Vietnam persisted. McNamara set McNaughton to work on a bombing pause designed to marshal world opinion in support of Government of Vietnam, U.S. position for peace, and for an independent South Vietnam. In addition, the president had received a recommendation from the new CIA director, Vice Admiral Rayburn, to halt the bombing temporarily to see if Hanoi was interested in serious negotiations. A pause in rolling thunder, Rayburn argued, would alleviate extreme world pressures. Like his predecessor, however, Rayburn believed that rolling thunder had to be intensified to hurt North Vietnam badly enough to cause the Hanoi regime to seek a political way out through negotiation rather than expose their economy to increasingly serious levels of destruction. After the United States proffered the olive branch, it might reapply the sword with renewed vigor. On May 10th, the president approved a 5-7 day bombing pause, codenamed Mayflower. The administration informed Moscow and Hanoi that it was prepared to open negotiations. The president intended to keep the pause secret and, if it failed, to publicize the administration's effort to make peace with Hanoi. Designed more to influence public opinion than to explore a diplomatic alternative, the bombing pause was destined to fail. Planning for the pause was rushed, and the American message to Hanoi was imprecise in language and threatening in tone. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko referred to the American effort as an ultimatum and refused to serve as intermediary between Washington and Hanoi. When the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Foy Kohler, had the message delivered to his North Vietnamese counterpart, the Hanoi embassy returned it without comment in a sealed envelope. When the British made a follow-up delivery, the Hanoi government rejected the offer unequivocally. The president kept knowledge of the pause limited to Rusk, McNamara, Rayburn, and the Bundy brothers. He did not inform the JCS until it was necessary for them to issue the orders to stop the bombing. Even then, the plan was not to be discussed by anyone at any time with anyone inside or outside the government. On May 12th, the day the pause began, LBJ sent Goodpaster to brief former President Eisenhower. Eisenhower supported the ultimatum that accompanied the bombing pause, recalling that during the Korean War, he had passed word to the Chinese that if they failed to stop the war, the United States would use nuclear weapons. Eisenhower advised Johnson, however, that the real problem in Vietnam seemed to lie with the South Vietnamese people. Goodpaster recorded Eisenhower's assessment that the important thing is that the people see real hope of progress. Eisenhower's final advice to Johnson was not to be too surprised or disturbed at the chatter from the incipient anti-war movement over the firm course the president is pursuing. A certain amount of this has to be expected. So long as the policies are right, too much attention need not be given to these people. The president and his advisors, however, remained preoccupied with public opinion. On May 16th, a Gallup poll revealed that 59% of the respondents favored the bombing of North Vietnam, while only 21% were against it. At 6:45 p.m. on the same day, the president met with Rusk, McNamara, Acheson, Ball, Rayburn, and presidential aide Jack Valenti to discuss when to end Mayflower. Once again, the JCS were left out of the decision-making process, having undertaken the bombing pause principally to quiet the opposition to Rolling Thunder. The president had begun to grow wary of potential charges from conservatives that the pause indicated a soft policy and a weak commitment to South Vietnam. McNamara seemed more concerned with the president's liberal constituency, however, and recommended letting the pause continue for 7 full days to satisfy the expectations of the New York Times editorial page. The president stated unambiguously that it was a pure question of what happens in this country. If we hold off the bombing any longer, people are going to say, what in the world is happening? The president told McNamara, my judgment is the public has never wanted us to stop the bombing. We have stopped in deference to Mansfield and Fulbright, but we don't want to do it too long, else we lose our base of support. At the end of a laborious discussion concerning domestic reaction to bombing, the president and his advisors decided to resume Rolling Thunder on May 18th. Despite Rayburn's recommendation that the first airstrikes after the pause apply force more dramatically, tight restrictions on the air campaign continued. At the May 16th meeting with the president, McNamara had argued against JCS recommendations to attack North Vietnamese surface-to-air missile or SAM sites. He spoke with the confidence of a seasoned air commander, explaining, we have to go after the MiG airfields first. First B-52s to plaster the airfields at night. There may be civilians involved, since all bombs won't hit target. Then fighter bombers go in, and then we take out the SAMs. McNamara observed that Hanoi would view the attack as a major operation, and noted that if the president delayed the attack on the missile sites until after they became operational, the most you would lose would be 3 to 4 crews. In August 1965, when the JCS received permission to strike the already established SAM sites, the attempt failed, with 13 jets lost. To keep the chiefs from asserting that the administration had gone soft, McNamara gained approval for an attack on a military barracks 10 miles further north than we have ever gone. He promised Dean Rusk, however, that he would keep the barracks off of the first day's target list. As McNamara endeavored to keep the bombing restricted, the Joint Chiefs continued to press for its intensification. McNamara, however, retained tight control of the air campaign and coordinated all targets with Rusk. On May 22nd, the JCS forwarded to McNamara a SYNC-PAC proposal to shift the air effort against the North to a combination of around-the-clock small strikes and deliberately planned large strikes aimed at inflicting maximum damage in a single day. Initially, SYNC-PAC would limit strikes to the area south of the 20th parallel, but subsequent raids would hit major military targets further north. The proposal would give SYNC-PAC greater autonomy in planning missions and increase the weekly allocation of sorties. McNamara took a full month to respond. He told the JCS that he saw no serious defects in the present method of planning Rolling Thunder operations. He stated that the airstrikes were militarily effective and managed in such a way as to permit political considerations to be taken into account on a timely basis. He doubted that a change in our method of planning Rolling Thunder operations would be desirable. The development of a weekly Rolling Thunder program, however, remained cumbersome and fragmented. The JCS focused on the positive objectives of interdicting the flow of men and supplies from north to south, and of destroying the will and capability of North Vietnam to continue its support for communist forces in South Vietnam, whereas civilian officials in the Departments of State and Defense emphasized the negative objectives of preventing further international and domestic opposition to the war, minimizing civilian collateral damage, and preventing the conflict from escalating. The development of Rolling Thunder Program 20, RT-20, to be executed in June 1965, was typical of the planning process. The JCS recommended that RT-20 include 14 targets. McNamara removed 6 from the JCS proposal. Wheeler then sent a draft planning message to SINCPAC. Simultaneously, the State Department and McNaughton at International Security Affairs received a copy. The State Department objected to one of the targets because it was too close to the port city of Haiphong, a SAM site, and Fujian Airfield. The target was actually 27 miles from the SAM site and 51 miles from the airfield. State Department officials also objected to the strike because it was too close to populated areas and could lead to high civilian casualties. McNaughton similarly informed McNamara that the target was the closest to Hanoi and Haiphong of those that Wheeler had recommended, and predicted that an airstrike in that vicinity might result in 30 civilian casualties. McNaughton argued that the strike was worth the potential collateral damage, however, and urged McNamara to approve it. McNamara, in deference to the State Department, deleted the target, while persuading Rusk to approve another good solid target to offer the chiefs in compensation. On June 23rd, the president met with his advisors to approve the target package personally. Using a large map, McNamara briefed the president on the compromise he had worked out with Dean Rusk. Although McNamara brought Vance and McNaughton to the meeting, no military officer was present. 6 days after the JCS had made their initial proposal, Wheeler sent the final orders for Rolling Thunder 20, consisting of 7 targets, to SINCPAC. The process focused civilian and military officials in the Department of Defense on choosing what specific targets would be hit in each Rolling Thunder program, rather than on developing a comprehensive strategic assessment of the air campaign. It is not surprising, then, that reports indicated that Rolling Thunder neither significantly impeded the flow of supplies to communist forces, nor discouraged North Vietnam from continuing its support for the war in the South. The JCS continued to press for a gradual relaxation of restrictions on the bombing, hoping to increase its effectiveness. Between May and July, McNamara permitted several extra armed reconnaissance missions against North Vietnamese supply lines, but only when such increases appeared necessary. Meanwhile, geographic limitations on interdiction missions and strikes against fixed targets gradually receded. Even as the president resisted JCS requests to intensify the air campaign, he emphasized the ground war in the South. Sending U.S. troops to fight in the South seemed the least expensive course of action in terms of domestic political reaction, even though McNamara and the president were aware of predictions that an expansion of the American effort on the ground would lead to a protracted, indecisive war that the United States would ultimately lose. On May 8th, Director of Central Intelligence Rayburn wrote to Johnson predicting, based largely on the French experience, that we will find ourselves pinned down with little choice left among possible subsequent courses of action, i.e., disengagement at very high cost or broadening the conflict in quantum jumps. Rayburn warned that the administration should not become preoccupied with military action and lose sight of the basically political aspect of the war. He agreed with Eisenhower that the critical factor was the loyalty and morale of the South Vietnamese people. The war would be won or lost at the hamlet level. He had based his letter in part on a special assessment from the CIA mission in Saigon. Although Taylor had once again deleted the worst news from the embassy's intelligence report, CIA officials transmitted the omitted text directly from their Saigon station to CIA headquarters. Johnson was sufficiently concerned to send Rayburn's assessment to his old friend and advisor, Clark Clifford. The Washington attorney responded with a one-page letter in which he made one major point. He advised the president to keep the number of U.S. ground troops in South Vietnam to a minimum, consistent with the protection of our installations and property in that country. He warned the president that this could be a quagmire. It could turn into an open-end commitment on our part that would take more and more ground troops without a realistic hope of ultimate victory. He recommended that the president pursue a negotiated settlement that the United States could learn to live with. As Ball recalled, the president and McNamara remained preoccupied with operational problems, however, because decisions based on political expediency had backed LBJ into a corner. More than 50,000 American troops were in South Vietnam by the 1st of June, and an additional 30,000 were on the way. Marine units were actively seeking close combat with Vietnamese Communist forces in the Da Nang area. When Ball and former Secretary of State Dean Acheson designed a plan to avert the gradual escalation of the conflict that they feared was inevitable under the current policy, it was already too late. Once Johnson committed ground combat troops, the actions of Vietnamese Communist forces would determine the level of American effort necessary to prevent a collapse of the South Vietnamese regime. The Communist summer offensive had begun on May 11th. Viet Cong troops quickly overran Song Bay, the capital of Phuc Long Province near Saigon. The attack inflicted high casualties on U.S. advisors and on South Vietnamese troops. Later in the month, the Viet Cong ambushed and destroyed a battalion of South Vietnamese troops in Quang Nai Province. In the ensuing battle, another Army of the Republic of Vietnam, or ARVN battalion, was lost. In addition to disastrous ARVN defeats, intelligence reports confirmed that the North Vietnamese had infiltrated an entire division into South Vietnam. Another division was moving south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. To make matters worse, the South Vietnamese government was again in turmoil. A confrontation between Premier Qua and Chief of State Su over the reorganization of the cabinet weakened the government. On June 11th, Qua ceded the Saigon government to the military, and the 8-month interlude of